Our Untangled Minds is for informational purposes only, and it does not constitute professional, medical, or psychological advice, diagnoses, and/or treatment. Please make sure that if you do have questions or concerns that are medical or psychological in nature, that you seek out your physician or qualified mental health provider for future help. Furthermore, the information, viewpoints, or opinions expressed in this podcast are solely the views of individuals that are involved. They do not represent absolute fact and are subject to change at any point in time. CUSM does not accept responsibility for these views. Lastly, the names and details of any medical stories shared in this episode have been edited for privacy.
Hey everyone, my name is Dhrupar Japtan. I'm a first-year medical student here at the California University of Science and Medicine, and welcome to our Untangled Minds podcast. Before we begin, I just wanted to bring up something that a classmate of mine recently brought up to me and I thought would be beneficial before we start this discussion today. They mentioned something like, you know, nothing quite immediately changes when you get into medical school, but rather it is a perception of others about you that changes. So what we're trying to do today is hopefully explore that you, the perception medical students have about themselves and how the field of counseling is helping medical students find themselves and not have others' perception define them on this journey, you know, to be a healer for their own community. So for this, we have a very special guest with us, our very own CUSM's very own Dr. Debbie Wright, an accomplished therapist and educator with extensive experience working with individuals, families, and organizations. Welcome, Dr. Wright. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So just to start a little bit, could you tell us a little bit about, you know, your background, how you ended up in the field of therapy, and even education?
Sure. Well, first I'll say that this is timely, this conversation, because this happens to be National Mental Health Awareness Month. So I couldn't have chosen a better time to have this conversation. I've been in, my career spans a number of years, but once I completed my master's in clinical social work, I worked for the county of mental health as a clinical therapist with a dual diagnosis population at an alcohol and drug outpatient clinic. From there, I worked as a case manager for an HMO, providing services to high-risk patients. Then I taught classes in a BSW program with undergraduate students. I also supervised students in clinical settings, served as a director of a university counseling center, and worked as a medical social worker in the ICU, DOU, post-surge, emergency room, and labor and delivery. And in addition to that, I worked as a hospice and home health social worker for a number of years. Other things that I've done, I've taught and supervised students for over 20 years in both undergraduate and higher education. Along the way, I became a licensed clinical social worker, and having that license actually gives me the ability to provide therapeutic services, either in a setting such as this or in private practice. And I also completed my doctorate in education, and my love for working with people in higher education settings brought me to COSM almost 5 years ago.
Well, that is certainly very impressive. I got to ask a quick question before we move on. What is DOU?
DOU, Definitive Observation Unit. So that's the unit for patients who are coming out of the ICU. Oh, so okay. It's like a step-down unit.
So step-down.
Yeah, okay. Still closely monitored, but not as critical as ICU.
Not as critical.
Yeah.
So in terms of counseling, how did that exactly work with these patients, you know, coming from critical care all the way down? Does that entail?
So sometimes I would float down to the ER. So I might see a patient who was admitted through ER who would then either go to surgery or be sent straight up to the ICU. A lot of my work at that point would be with the families, providing a lot of counseling services, providing resources. If the patient was determined to be critical, terminal, and not going to make it, then I would work with them on finding or making funeral arrangements, making phone calls to family members. I have done lots of different things in that arena, and not all good. Some of the situations were really tragic, and some had great outcomes. And if they were able to, you know, pull through the crisis state and then go to DOU and make it through and maybe go to rehab after, you know, that period. Sometimes they would come back 3 to 6 months later and come in and just say, do you remember me? And they'd come up and hug us and just tell us what their recovery process has been. So that was always rewarding.
Right. I mean, I can definitely see, you know, how rewarding that could be. You know, you've done so much, especially for that one patient. And it just means a lot when they, you know, they pull through at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's great. Great to hear.
Yeah.
So just moving along, obviously, a very impressive resume and certainly a long journey to where you have been, you know, where you are today. So I would like to take some little bit of time to unpack a little bit of the journey a little bit more. That's okay. So first, can you help us understand, you know, the intricacies of what entails clinical versus medical social worker? I know you already touched upon that a little bit. So perhaps a little bit more. And then secondly, how these experiences have like shaped you and your view of our healthcare system in relationship to, you know, our own medical workforce?
Well, having the clinical experience first in the early part of my career gave me a great foundation and helped me build a skill set that allowed me to go into a hospital setting and work with any and everything from teenagers who came in and worked, you know, brain injuries, and working with those who were dying, just the whole lifespan. I had to have those clinical skills in place to be able to do that kind of work effectively.
Right.
And not be afraid of the death and dying process. I guess that's a whole other topic, but I mean, you can expect to see that, you know, when you're working in the ER or you're working in the ICU. So the biggest difference is that this medical social worker focuses on patients in both an inpatient or outpatient setting, providing case management services, discharge planning, and other areas that are related to the patient's care, you know, such as hospital, clinic, medical group practice, et cetera, with the focus being on health-related issues, right? Because the goal is if they can recover, to make sure they go home, they go to rehab or they go home and they have all the adaptive equipment they need so that they can still function at home and do relatively well with maybe a home health aide or, you know, home health nursing or whatever may be, you know, for a period of time. Specifically, the clinical social worker who might be in private practice or just, you know, doing therapy, will focus on the mental health aspects. That's the primary focus. Now, if they identify that the person's anxiety or depression may be related to a health challenge, we always do rule outs and we always want to send them back to their, you know, go check with your physician, make sure X, Y, and Z is in order, have lab work done, get this checked out, and then we will continue our work. But the focus with strictly clinical work is mental health.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was certainly a great deal to think about. And I think one of the things that you brought up that I would like to perhaps know a little bit more about was you as a counselor dealing with the death and dying. Obviously, it is a very touchy subject. We all have different ways to process that. You know, being a medical student myself, I will, you know, unfortunately come in contact with that myself moving like third year onwards. My experience totally would be different than, say, a counselor. So as a counselor, how do you, I guess, deal with that or help others deal with death?
So in the medical setting or if I'm working with students now and
so I guess for right now, at least with the students ourselves, you know, we go through that a lot, especially as third and fourth years. And then as a counselor yourself in the clinical setting, I'm sure you dealt with the other side of things with the patients and their families. So if you could touch upon either or.
Sure. So working with patients, I did hospice social work for a while and really it's helping the patient if they're able to communicate. By the time I would go out, often they were semi-comatose at home or in a facility or working with families or both, helping them come to grips with the diagnosis. Sometimes it's real sudden and there isn't a lot of time. You know, if they've been given 4 or 6 weeks, there's not a lot of time to come to grips with that. And they still have a lot of unfinished business. So it's identifying what the immediate impact is and maybe calling family members, having them come in, thinking about some things that they want to do. I always say I would always tell them just because you have this diagnosis doesn't mean you sit here and you just wait for death to occur.
Right.
Are there some things you want to do? So some patients wanted to go to the casino or person wanted to go to Walmart. Somebody wanted to travel to see their kids. If they were well enough, then we encouraged that because really it's still part of trying to live and have, you know, meaningful experiences, however long they had left. So helping the families and helping the patients come to terms. Also, I found there was a lot of unresolved grief, a lot of anger, a lot of unresolved issues among family members, and it would play out during this time. I've said that you see the best and worst in people at weddings and funerals or during the preparation time for someone's death.
Right.
All of the stuff that's been tucked away comes up at that time. And so it can be ugly. It can be cathartic. I mean, I've seen some beautiful things happen and some not.
Right.
So I hope so that was that part. Working with students, it can be shocking, especially if grief hasn't really touched you or impacted you. And then you're a third year doing your rotation and you're in surgery or, you know, family medicine and you lose a patient.
Right.
That can really throw you off your tracks. What I'm finding is students need a space to talk about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the hospital, it's so busy. And many of the areas that students are working in, no one really makes the time or has the time to sit down. So tell me how you feel and, you know, how did this impact you, da-da-da-da-da. You just go on to the next patient.
Correct.
And so you're left with all this stuff. And it's like, what do I do with this?
Right.
How do I unpack this? How do I move forward? Maybe a student has recently lost a loved one or they're dealing with a sick loved one. And there's a patient who brings all of that up because the patient's illness might remind them of their family member's illness and so forth. So there's many different ways it can all play out. So if they do come to see me, we work on processing all of that.
Wow. I mean, that's certainly a lot for one person to be in, you know, in the middle, especially when you're dealing with the patient and their family and then a new med student essentially going through life for the very first time. So that's certainly a lot. And thank you for sharing all that. It means a lot and it helps us a lot, you know. Now we'll be focusing a little bit more towards your journey from the educational standpoint a little bit. Can you tell us about any particular experiences, you know, that shaped your career path in terms of your educational journey away from like the clinical aspect and more into like your current role, especially towards, you know, medical education or higher education?
So my journey into higher ed?
Correct, essentially, because, you know, you started with working as a hospice and then also clinical worker, but now you've been, you know, well-versed in helping students out for quite a while and moving on to higher education. So just that journey itself.
So I left the medical side years ago and started teaching at the undergraduate level and realized I really loved it. Really loved it. I loved the interaction. I loved working with students from their first year of college all the way up to graduation. I'm like, wow, it's amazing and it's humbling.
Right.
It's a privilege to be part of that process. And I left. I had my third child, so I needed to work part-time. That's why I left. But I absolutely loved teaching. And then I went back to the medical setting and started, you know, doing the work again, went back to ICU, and then I ended up floating over to fill in hospice and then ended up doing that for 6 years for the same organization. But I was able to really use a lot of my teaching skills with family members. So, yes, there's the working with them on identifying stressors and triggers and ways to cope and ways to accept, if you can say that, their loved one's illness or death. But also there was a lot of education that went along with that whole process. And also working with other clinicians in the hospital. It wasn't just social work. I worked very closely with the nursing team. I worked with physicians, and there were some physicians. We had a really good working relationship, and they would often have me going with them to sit with the patients while they gave them, you know, their diagnosis or said, okay, we're getting ready to send you home. You know, Debbie's going to help you with X, Y, and Z. So there was a good partnership. So since that time, I have equally loved the teaching and the medical side. I can't say I love one more than the other.
Gotcha.
So being here to me is like the best of both worlds.
Wow. Well, that's certainly interesting to hear because, you know, initially when I think of a counselor, it's usually in a seat sitting one-on-one with someone. But seeing how dynamic this role is to where you can interplay with so many different specialties, you know, inside and outside of clinical settings is truly amazing. And see, you know, The field has so much more to offer to everyone, you know. So that's wonderful to hear. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. So as you may be aware, many of our listeners are undergraduates and maybe going through their own struggles as one does, you know. And can you please elaborate perhaps more on the struggle aspect you touched upon earlier, specifically in this population of undergraduates?
So one of, I worked previously, before I came to CUSM, I worked at another institution with primarily serving undergraduate students. Right. So the demographic was different. Yeah. Some students as young as 16 or 17 away from home for the first time.
Right.
So there's, you know, there's a big age developmentally already between, you know, going to college in your teens versus starting graduate school in your, you know, mid-20s, a little bit later. You're in a different place. So the undergraduates often were dealing with loneliness, acceptance, wanting to fit in, trying new things out, which sometimes got them in trouble. There were no boundaries there, and especially if they were dorming, there was no one to say, don't do this or don't do that. Right. You know, no parents saying, get up and get dressed and, you know, go to school kind of thing. And so missing classes and partying and, you know, the whole culture that sometimes can form when the students leave home for the first time, roommate challenges, relationships, how to form meaningful relationships, substance use, misuse, students who maybe had some mental health challenges and chose college to be the first time to not address that or not take medication because mom isn't there or dad isn't there to say, hey, I'm going to take you to see your therapist or this or that. And even though I think most undergraduate universities now have counseling available in one form or another. So those resources are there. They may be stretched a little thin at some schools more than others, but there were so many issues that came up with the undergraduate students, even health issues, not just mental health, but physical health.
Right.
Students may be developing a chronic illness or a chronic illness that was managed before has gotten out of control because maybe they're not sleeping well. They're not taking their meds properly. They're not, you know, they haven't adjusted well and there's no one there to kind of oversee it like a parent might do.
Right.
And things can get out of control. I worked at a campus where there were dorms. And so I saw quite a bit.
Yeah, I can definitely sympathize with that. You know, as an undergrad myself, you know, I feel like I've gone through quite a fair share. And in hindsight, I do wish at times I did seek out a counselor just to, you know, talk to someone, even if it was nothing serious or nothing too deep. You know, it always doesn't hurt to just reach out and see, you know, maybe they can help me one way or another just by talking to me. So if someone else out there is in a similar position, you know, we just encourage everyone to seek, you know, a counselor and just talk to someone in your vicinity and just talk it out and see how it goes from there.
Excellent point. And I will say, I will disclose this, when I was an undergraduate student, I started my college experience fresh off from losing my father suddenly. And by the end of my first year, I found my way to the counseling center. Now, that was something that was totally new for me because in my family, people didn't go out to a stranger and talk about this stuff. You found a trusted person within your family to do it. And that may be cultural as well, but I found someone and it was really helpful to have someone who could be objective, who was actually a stranger, but that's what helped them be objective, right? Because they were not connected to me emotionally and just knew what to ask and how to ask it so that I could process a lot of those emotions. I mean, we have students, undergraduate and even here, who are dealing with loss.
Right.
Impending or current.
Exactly.
You know, and it's painful. And then you have to continue to be a student on top of all of that. So what do you do with all of these emotions if you're not talking about it?
Exactly. I mean, it's certainly a lot. I definitely get the cultural aspect, you know. Myself being from India, like born and raised and immigrated here, mental health isn't something you openly talk about. Mm-hmm. Even though, quote unquote, I'm Americanized now, you know, it's still something we shy away from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you say, you know, you'll be fine and you move on. But I think hopefully, and I've kind of noticed that it has been changing, at least with my generation onwards. Mm-hmm. So hopefully the stigma, you know, slowly but surely goes away. But thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you've been here at CUSM more than 4 years, almost five now.
Yeah. So September 3 will be my fifth year starting.
Well, almost congratulations, just Thank in you. Case, you know. I don't like see you around that time. So I'm sure the experience that's been that you've had here is in contrast to obviously the undergraduate mm-hmm. education that you mentioned. In your view, how are the struggles of a medical student different from an undergraduate, and are there common themes? I mean, obviously we touched upon certain aspects of mm-hmm. a medical student, you know, like seeing the death and dying, obviously that's mm-hmm. quite different. Perhaps anything other you would like to share?
Yeah, career. I mean, yes, you know you're here because you want to become a physician, right?
Right.
But what kind of physician do you want to become?
Right.
And
that's a big question.
That's a big question, even in the third and fourth year. And really, that's where you're applying everything that you've learned to the clinical setting so you can try out the different areas in your mm-hmm. rotations so you get a better sense of whether or not you can see yourself doing that
exactly.
the rest of your working years,
exactly.
you know? So there can be a little bit of individuals feeling unsettled mm-hmm. as they're trying to navigate the career path. And that's why we have great resources here as well.
Right.
You know, people who are trained in the career part, and they can actually help students navigate those waters. But as far as mental health, anxiety and depression have to be the top two issues that students present with. And that's not just here. That's
right.
across the nation among all colleges mm-hmm. and universities.
Right.
Those are the top two issues. And the pandemic didn't help things.
No.
If people weren't anxious or depressed before, they got a little bit of that during that uncertain period where all of our lives had been impacted one way or another. And
exactly.
we were all in a bubble and mm-hmm. we didn't know what the outcome was going to be, right?
Right?
So it created a lot of doubt, a lot of fear. Watching the news was really scary. And it contributed to a lot of stress.
Right.
Just across the board. So for medical students, yeah, careers, I would say anxiety and depression, relationships.
Mm-hmm.
People are moving on to that next period in life where they're in committed relationships, perhaps, and maybe
right.
getting married or, you know, getting, you know, living together and starting families all while being medical students.
Exactly. Yeah, I would have to say, like, being in a relationship definitely has to be one of the hardest parts.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like as a medical student because... it probably would cross your mind saying, who do I devote most of my time to? You know,
yeah.
so much of your time goes to school, but you also want to make sure you're engaged with your own family and
mm-hmm.
friends outside, you know, those kind of relationships. So it's definitely hard to maintain. And if you're going through something in your relationship, like more of a down or like
mm-hmm.
a breakup or divorce, in the midst of your medical school career, it could be a lot. And this is when you need most of the support.
Yeah. You know? And it can derail people. And I think it's important, again, for the partners, for family members to have somewhat of a good understanding at the beginning of their loved one's medical school experience
mm-hmm.
of the impact that medical school is going to have on them. Like, they're not going to be able to come home every night or on the weekend for dinner or pick up this sibling or expected to
right.
function the way they functioned before they were in graduate school. It just... probably won't happen.
Right.
It's too stressful. I mean, you're all of you are about to finish your first year next week and you're stretched thin.
Right.
You know, there's not much wiggle room for extra things, even if it is hanging out with family. Now, some people are still living with their families and so they've figured out this past year or past years, you know, how to navigate all of that. But
mm-hmm.
it's not everybody has it where there's understanding and give, you know,
right.
As far as the individual not being fully present physically and emotionally within their family unit.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. I mean, I know personally, I live with my family at home
mm-hmm.
and initially I thought there may be something I may not like initially, but I think overall my own consensus is that I do love it. And it's definitely helped me a lot with my own mental health and stress
mm-hmm.
long-term, you know, just having two pillars in my life that I know I can like, you know, rely on at
mm-hmm.
the end of the day, you know, come back home to something that, you know, they're looking forward to meeting me and talking to me about, you know, how my day went
mm-hmm.
and especially like not judging.
And so that's wonderful. And you've got, I'm sure, great food and you've got your,
right.
your space, right? Your comfortable space, which helps, right?
It does. It definitely helps because I didn't have as big of a change or a shock, if you want to say, moving to medical school just
mm-hmm.
because I only had to switch gears from not quite studying to studying instead of moving to a whole different city,
mm-hmm.
to a whole different, you know, group of friends and mm-hmm. everything like that. So that definitely comes in play. And obviously people may have different experiences than I do, even if they go to school like 20 minutes away, you know. So it just depends on the person, I would say, at the end of the day, like that. But yeah. So moving a little bit onwards now, obviously we touched on how it is different for medical students versus undergraduates, their approach to therapy. How would you say the coping techniques are for medical students? Like, what can medical students use to cope, perhaps, during this tough time?
Yeah, so usually at orientation, I encourage everybody to build a community.
Right.
Family is an instant community if it's a good community.
Correct.
Right? And friends, choose wisely. Not everybody in your class you'll be close to. I mean, it's just too big and unrealistic to expect that. But find the people whose values align with yours. Mm-hmm. Find people inside or outside who support you.
Right.
And will call you out on stuff if they need to. Right. Because friendship, it's not just everything being great. It's if you're messing up, like, hey, I'm concerned about you. What's going on there? This doesn't seem like you kind of thing. Do you need to talk? Mm-hmm. Let's go out and, you know, eat or meet up or whatever.
Correct.
So building that community, of course, finding someone, and it doesn't have to be me's, but we do have a student assistance plan, which provides an online telehealth service, which provides up to 5 sessions for free for the students.
Right.
I don't get any reports of who accesses services and what for. It's mm-hmm. just an additional thing. If somebody's more comfortable seeing somebody on the outside, then they can. Mm-hmm. And then if a student comes to me and they're really stressed out because they didn't do well on an exam, or their study skills need help, they need more structure, I can direct them to somebody on campus because the stress could be just related to that, right?
Right.
So I can send them to, you know, Sabrina, who can get them matched up with a tutor. I can now send them to PACE. We have this new department. So there are many resources on campus, which if the student is able to tap into those services and use them and apply, then it will help alleviate, mm-hmm. you know, some of the stressors that are tied in with, you know, test performance and all of that. So finding resources, finding someone to direct you. I don't know. I'll say, you know what? I'm not sure, but let me look into that for you. They might need a psychiatrist. We'll look at their insurance and see what they can tap into through there. Sometimes students need a medication evaluation. Mm-hmm. So I'll, you know, refer them out and get that process started. There can be lots of different, there are lots of different reasons why a student might need to be referred out, and there's lots of different things students can do to help minimize, you know, the stress that they're experiencing. I would just say, do not sit with it. Mm-hmm. Do not think it's just going to go away.
Right.
Because it builds.
Definitely.
It really does build up, and then it can play out in other ways. You know, you start getting sick, your hair's falling out, you're not eating, and you're not sleeping, and it will show itself one way or another.
Exactly.
So hopefully, did I answer that?
Definitely helps.
Okay.
And obviously, depending on where any student is or any listener is, they have different mm-hmm. resources, especially mm-hmm. different colleges have different resources. So, you know, just tap out, mm-hmm. you know, to see, like, what do you have available? Just ask around at that, you know, at the end of the day, just so that you have someone there to talk through and take you through things.
And I'll tell you here, faculty and staff are very caring and knowledgeable.
Right.
So some will refer to me, they'll refer to each other. If a student needs something very specific regarding, you know, let's just say it's anatomy or something mm-hmm. else, the faculty member will be able to direct the student to somebody else who can fill in the blanks.
Exactly.
To help.
Gotcha. Well, Dr. Wright, the work you and the other counselors do is amazing, obviously, mm-hmm. and we need more of that, if anything. We have known, you know, for years about mental health and how addressing it is vital at the end of the day, you know, especially for future physicians. Yet even with all this awareness, it seems there's something that's missing, if that makes sense, like limited resources, perhaps, even though we've known this for years that, you know, mm-hmm. we need to tackle mental illnesses or mental health in general. Why do you think that is? You know, what resources would you like to see, you know, more of in general at USM or otherwise provided for mental health?
Okay, so we'll start with the state level. The governor has actually issued millions of dollars to K through 12 schools across the state to provide mental health, licensed mental health professionals at on school campuses. So there will be more mental health care beginning at an earlier age rather than, you know, addressing it now from kindergarten, you know, through high school. And then when they get to college, there's usually, you know, mental health services there.
Right.
However, keeping that in mind, college campuses tend to be understaffed just because the needs of the students are great.
Exactly.
And there are waiting lists. Yes, there are waiting lists, even the insurances that have mental health care built in there. Sometimes there's a 4 to 8 week wait, which is not good practice, if, especially if you're in crisis.
Right.
You know, you don't want to have to wait for a follow-up for that amount of time. So we've seen a lot of telehealth organizations pop up since the pandemic where people are able, you know, BetterHelp and talk therapy, Timely MD. There's lots and lots out there. So people can either pay out of pocket or their insurances now are starting to contract with these outside agencies to be able to provide services at a faster rate than what they're able to do inside. So that's what's happening from the state all the way to, you know, local communities and organizations here. So there's me. When I started, we only had, we had two classes, first and second year med students.
Right.
And then we had our MBS students. And, you know, they're here for just 9 months and then they graduate. Now we're, you know, at full capacity. And eventually the goal is for me to have another clinician, perhaps have a graduate student intern helping. So that'll help with the work. And I see my role in addition to like the one-on-one, but doing more outreach, which I haven't been able to do as much of because they're just me. But that's my goal, to really do more outreach with the wellness events. I work with students and, you know, I'm usually at some of the programs that happen. So I love interacting with students. That actually is kind of like my shot in the arm. That's my boost when I get to, you know, interact with students and talk and find out how they're doing and to see the progress. We just need more, and I think in time we'll be able to grow. I will be able to grow my department, but there are other people on this campus who I collaborate with, you know, EIDP and PACE and Student Affairs. If I need something, I'm able to pull in an extra person if I need to. I mean, not in my counseling center, but if I need resources and so forth. So there's a lot of collaboration that goes on. To, hopefully I've answered your question.
No, you're good, okay. Appreciate the answer. And yeah, I mean, as much help as you need, you know, and hopefully fast, they can provide that to you. Obviously, we've been talking a little bit about counseling in general. And then I just wanted to touch a little bit on how the counseling sessions actually go. Because, you know, there's one thing, try to seek counseling, but also at the same time being afraid of not knowing what that even entails, especially like a person like me who's busy. You know, with it, you only have 24 hours and you try to do so many things, try to juggle. And you're at the end of the day, you know, you still want to seek some sort of counseling, but don't know what that means.
What that means. Yeah, it's a great, great question. And it's that uncertainty that prevents a lot of people from even scheduling an appointment. It's the fear of the unknown. And we've already touched on the cultural stuff. If you were raised in a home where you just didn't talk about family business to a stranger, then you're never going to cross into that room.
Yeah, exactly.
I implemented this year, and you may or may not remember from orientation, encouraging students to come in and just meet with me for 15 minutes for a non-clinical appointment. So I had a number of students in the first 2 months who came in. I had a steady stream of students, and you know, many of those appointments turned into additional appointments. But really, it's to introduce the student to the space. That's a big part of it. Just to see what my office looks like, to meet me, to have just a conversation. We can talk about the weather. We can talk about what they did over the summer. It can be anything. Just for them to have a chance to get to know me a little bit better, so that if they get to a point in time where they're just super stressed and they feel like it might be useful to talk to someone, they'll consider me and say, well, I know what it looks like. It's not as scary. There's the little couch and she sits over there, and you know, we'll go in and talk. I try to make the setting as comfortable as possible. Mm-hmm. Students can, you know, schedule an appointment through the portal in Canvas. If they get stuck there, they either call me or they email me, and we get it all taken care of. Mm-hmm. I usually do a consultation first, like, you know, tell me, right. I go over informed consent and then ask them, you know, what brings them in, what would they like to focus on, mm-hmm. what would be helpful if they've had therapy in the past. I say, you know, what did you work on? What was helpful? What wasn't? Mm-hmm. What do you wish you had done differently, or the therapist done differently, or why didn't it work? You mm-hmm. seem upset, you know, fill in the blanks, or, oh, it went really well for you, but right. it's been a few years, it seems like. So tell me at this present time how mm-hmm. I can be of assistance to you. And we just go from there. It's just really a conversation.
Right. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. Obviously, you want to start, make sure everyone feels comfortable with, you know, each other mm-hmm. in the first place. I guess that brings me on to, like, the second portion of it. At the end of the day, you know, you want to be counseled by someone who understands you, and you want to make sure as a counselor mm-hmm. that they also understand where you're coming from. But sometimes personalities may not gel. So mm-hmm. as a counselor, how do you point, you know, your own patients or students to other resources outside if they, you know?
No, that's a great question. Yeah. And sometimes students may wish to discuss certain concerns with someone the same gender as them. Mm-hmm. If it's a male, they may want to, you know, and right. unfortunately, it's just me right now. But right. it's nice to have that choice where, you know, there's, you know, one of each gender and that option is there. Because I totally get that. So if they're, sometimes personalities just don't mesh.
Right.
And that's okay. I don't take it personally. Mm-hmm. I ask students at the end of a first session, you know, what does this feel like right now? Is this something you can see yourself continuing with? Mm-hmm. If so, I'd be happy to schedule another appointment. And if they say no, then I'll say, you know, how can I help? Right. And then so we talk about utilizing their insurance.
Right.
And students come here already having had many therapists in the past,
right.
but because they've moved out of town or it's, you know, they're in school now and it's just easier to tap into resources here, they do that. But they always have the option of going back
right.
to okay. their therapist or looking for a specialist mm-hmm. In the community. And again, we always have to check insurance and all of that stuff. It's not as easy nowadays to just say, here, go and see Dr. So-and-so or this person. And we have to make sure that, you know, the insurance is accepted.
Gotcha.
So
thank you. That's really actually helpful in understanding the whole process and just seeing, you know, how it might mm-hmm. look if I was to even attend a session mm-hmm. and just put my mind at ease, you know, as a student.
The most important thing for me in the beginning is connecting with the student
right.
and helping them to feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen students hold it together walking through the outer door, and then they come in and it's just tears.
Right.
And them being shocked that, you know, they've just had this release of right. emotion. And I get it. It's like sometimes you hold on to stuff for so long and it's pent up and you don't realize how much you've been carrying. Mm-hmm. And then you come into the space and it feels safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just release it.
Exactly.
So we just sit in it for a little bit. It's okay. And just let them be. And then we move forward.
That sounds so calming and peaceful. Should probably try that out sometimes, honestly. Okay, so moving on a little bit. So as you know, one of the things in news that we hear often is the suicide rate among physicians and the burnout, you know, mm-hmm. Has been very considerable, especially during COVID times. It's been quite high. What do you make of this, and like, how can we combat that perhaps, you know, even earlier before we even, you know, go on to become an attending or a physician?
Yeah. This process you go through as a medical student is unlike any other.
Right.
I don't get it totally because I'm not in it. I know the stress of, you know, graduate school, mm-hmm. but you are put through the ringer, and it's like, get in, buckle up, and get ready for that roller coaster and hold on tight. Sometimes you feel like you're going to fall out of mm-hmm. the, you know, the roller coaster ride because it's so bumpy, it's so rough. But you make it to the end,
yeah.
and hopefully you will have, you know, picked up enough resources and things along the way that will help sustain you on that journey. Mm-hmm. There are still those who, for whatever reason, don't seek out care when they need it. Mm-hmm. People get sick, like physically sick,
right.
You know, along the way, sometimes not related to school, but just, you know, life happens. Mm-hmm. They lose people. They have traumatic events all while trying to be students and don't take the time to address that. And then you get into that arena where, okay, you've got the MD behind your name. Now you're a resident. Mm-hmm. And it can be lonely. And the hours, depending on your specialty, can be right. grueling. Like if you know you're doing surgery, you're doing one of those where right. you've got these wild hours, yep. 80-hour weeks or whatnot. And what is the quality of life?
Right.
You don't want to think all I do is work, work, work. You got to have some play. You got to have some balance
right.
in there. But I do think that a lot of mental health issues go undetected, uncared for, mm-hmm. you know, unaddressed early on.
Right.
And because the stigma there, mm-hmm. You've heard of, I would imagine, Dr. Lorna Breen.
I'm not quite familiar.
So she was the physician. She was an emergency room physician in New York City at Ground Zero mm-hmm. during the pandemic, who unfortunately, she caught COVID. Didn't feel she had to take time off because she got so sick, but
right.
didn't feel like she could really continue her downtime or her caring for herself mm-hmm. And went back to work after 3 weeks. And she ended up mm-hmm. taking her life.
Right.
And I went to a conference last year and her brother-in-law and sister were there and mm-hmm. they have been to Congress since then and trying to create the Lorna Breen, Dr. Lorna Breen Act, and it has to do with mental health stigma among physicians. She didn't feel she could tell anybody
right.
that she was depressed. All right. she was working like long shifts in the ER, taking on all these extra shifts because people were either getting sick, dying, the people she was mm-hmm, working with, mm-hmm. or just didn't want to go in. And right. it took its toll, unfortunately. She was a vibrant, you know, lovely woman and mm-hmm. It's just really, really sad. So out of that, her family, they were determined that people get to know who she was as a person, mm-hmm. not how it ended, but how she lived. And that's what
right.
her brother-in-law said. And so they've been to Congress. And there's people behind the scenes like them mm-hmm. working toward bringing more awareness to the mental health of physicians, because you all will see so much
right.
in your careers,
right.
no matter what specialty you go into, some mm-hmm. more than others, mm-hmm. that will change your life and things that you'll never be able to unsee. And that takes its toll on you. And so you've got to have good outlets. If you need to go see a physician, go see a physician, you know, just or
right.
a psychiatrist or, you know, a therapist, go find someone to talk to, have an outlet,
right.
participate in sports and, you know, your faith communities, if you have one, and family and friends, and just try and create as much balance as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's there. You're going into a field that is very demanding mentally
right.
and physically, and it will challenge you
Correct.
In every which way.
Right.
Challenge everything you've ever thought.
Yeah. No, I definitely understand. I mean, having the stigma, you know, around mental illness
mm-hmm.
in your own medical field that's supposed to address is hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember going through the medical school cycle in general and just contemplating whether or not I should bring up something even similar on my own applications.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up doing that, I believe, for a few of them. And I was surprised to see how well received they were during some interviews, which made me feel a lot more comfortable,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the people who were interviewing me and potentially the school if I was to attend mm-hmm. that. So I would like to personally think, you know, that tide slowly but slowly is like shifting,
mm-hmm.
but there's still a considerable amount of stigma that is still out there. But then, you know, for the providers themselves.
Absolutely.
So
Absolutely.
It's definitely hard to deal with sometimes, but I'm glad to know that
yeah.
there's something being done on for that, you know, on a national and federal mm-hmm. level.
Yeah, it's forward. A work in progress, just working on the stigma. And I have a little sticker that says, we take care of our physical health, we should take care of our mental health as well.
Right.
Yeah. It's all part of it.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's all part of it, you know. How can one be truly healthy if, you know, your own soul or like your inside is not
right.
at the end
right.
of the day? So I think that truly is vital
mm-hmm.
in this case. But thank you for sharing all this,
You're welcome.
Dr. Wright. Yeah. So counseling as a field is truly amazing. You know, it's mm-hmm. been helping us for quite some time at this point. So what advice perhaps would you give to someone, you know, who's considering pursuing this career in, you know, in therapeutic counseling moving forward?
There are different avenues to get there, mm-hmm. whether it's an MD who wants to go into psychiatry. I mean, some psychiatrists still, you know, do therapy in addition to the right. medication piece. So when I'm an LCSW, there's, you know, licensed marriage and family therapists, mm-hmm. licensed practical counselors. There are other different types of areas that people go into, psychologists and PsyDs right. and so forth. Doing the research, so for undergraduate students, doing the research and finding out what each one is and where they can work. Where can you apply that degree? And how much leverage will you have in each area, and seeing which one is a good fit for them.
Right.
Because each of them has a little bit of something different from the next one. Mm-hmm. And so it just depends on what really speaks to you
right.
as an individual. And I like the human service piece, so that's why I chose social work.
Right.
I was actually a child development major mm-hmm. and long story, but anyways, fell into this field, and it pulled me in. I just love working with people and organizations and communities and all of that. That doesn't speak to everybody. So right. some people want to focus on, you know, the family, and they specialize on that, and that, and, you know, the theory and the systems and all of that. Mm-hmm. Do the research, including where you can work with that particular degree.
Right.
And mm-hmm. talk to people who are doing the work. Mm-hmm. Shadow if you can.
Right.
And most of those programs actually require some sort of internship or externship mm-hmm. for a number, you know, right. you've got to get in, get your hours. I had to do 3,200 hours post-master's
wow. okay.
To be of supervision before I could even sit for my licensing exams.
Wow. That's
so it was quite, a lot.
Quite a lot. Yeah, that is quite a lot indeed, yeah.
yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, I think one of the other things, obviously, a person requires, regardless of the field, is, you know, strong commitment and eagerness, you mm-hmm. know, to always learn in that sense. And obviously, you know, learning and having professional development through and through.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I guess, what capacity as a counselor are you yourself, I guess, learning and developing, would you say? And can you perhaps provide an example of something?
Sure. I love learning. And I feel we should never think that we have arrived or we're self-actualized if we're looking at Maslow's, you know, pyramid.
Right, right.
We always should be in the mindset of learning. Mm-hmm. So for me, I have to renew my license every 2 years, which means I have to obtain 36 hours of continuing education units,
right.
which I just renewed last year. Yes, I renewed last year. So next year I'm up again. So I attend conferences and law and ethics. I have to get 6 to 8 hours each renewing cycle mm-hmm. of law and ethics to make sure I'm up to date on the latest and the greatest mm-hmm. when it comes to that. And then I can attend any other conference that's offering CEUs in my discipline
right.
that is approved by the Board of Behavioral Sciences.
Right.
But I do online trainings and mm-hmm. I go in person to things. I'm reading and listening to books on Audible. I mean, I try
right.
and make use of my time
right,
often
right.
and just, I like learning. So that's just what I do.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
And I see that you went to a recent AMC conference in Hawaii.
I did. Yeah. I did.
That must be a fun time.
It's beautiful.
I wish I could go to Hawaii. Yeah. They should send us for rotations to Hawaii. Honestly, 10 out of 10 would just join a school just for that.
There's a big hospital there.
Yeah, for sure. Hopefully it's on my agenda, though. One way or another, got to go to Hawaii one of these days. But thank you for your words, Dr. Wright.
Absolutely.
You know. Could you perhaps now tell us a little bit more about the challenging aspects of being a counselor, especially, you know, for physicians or future physicians who will be counselors themselves, perhaps,
yeah.
you know, moving forward?
To stay in tune, be in tune with what's going on with you, right? As long as we're living, we're going to have different experiences, different challenges, different bumps along the way, whether it's, you know, sickness, and within ourselves or somebody else, or birth of a child, or moving cross country, moving away from family, buying a house. I mean, all of these life events
right.
can totally stress us out, right? And yet we carry these things, and then we're supposed to go in and sit across from a patient and just be totally focused and zeroed in on them, when the back of my mind, it's like, oh my gosh, is the loan going to go through? Is the baby going to be okay? And is this and is that? You know, you're trying to conversations going on up here, and then you're trying to focus in on your patient. So really being in tune with what's going on with you and finding the space or creating the space to address that. Again, talking to someone, talking to, you know, a family, friend, partner, spouse, clergy, whomever it is, mm-hmm. just not sitting with all of this stuff because you don't want to explode and you don't ever want to not be present in the presence of your patient.
Right.
Because you can sit there, but you're really not there because your mind is on 50 other things. So if you're exhausted, if you're burned out, recognize that and do something about it.
Right.
Go to Hawaii.
Go to
if you can.
For free?
Or garden. Or, you know, there are things we can do that don't cost anything. We, you know, there are public places, there are museums, there's parks, there's, you know, you can, you know, people play sports, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Just have outlets because that's what really sparks us and fuels us. And I always say, you know, rest, recharge, and refuel. Mm-hmm. Make sure you get good sleep, which will allow you to recharge. And recharging can be hanging out with people, you know, that you care about. You want to use your time, spend your time with them. And it refuels you and it gets you ready for the next step, whatever it is. So just being cognizant of what's going on with you internally so that you can be, a better practitioner with your patients.
Very understandable. Thank you for sharing that. I guess kind of like the similar theme. Have you by any chance met like past students and have they told you anything about, you know, getting counseling themselves from either you or otherwise and how that may have helped them?
Yes. I'm just thinking carefully. I have periodically. I run into students from my previous place of employment, and it's nice to see how they've moved on. Right. You know, they might have gone on to grad school or started a family, and they'll bring up something. I remember when you said this, and I'll think, what was it I said? You know, they'll hold on to one sentence or one paragraph that really changed their lives. So I absolutely love that. I love the feedback and love to see that they've moved on and they're living their best lives and doing what is meaningful for them. Having that person you can talk to at such a critical point in your life can make all the difference. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a make or break situation.
Gotcha. Well, that's certainly powerful, you know, when people come and tell you, you know, they remember you and, you know, they certainly took something away, something positive at least, away from your interaction with them. So that's definitely lovely. I remember when I was volunteering as a pre-med, at this volunteering place, they said, you know, you may just seem like this is volunteering, but to the patients who you're helping out, there's been times where, you know, you just randomly meet them, they remember you as just a volunteer and tell you, you know, how amazing it was just having you there and just talk to someone, you know, or just like getting a glass of water handed to them, a warm blanket or things like that at the end of the day. So definitely it's very powerful.
I do have one situation I'd like to, I know we're running over time, but I was at a meeting a couple of months ago and I had a former student intern. Gosh, it's been about 12 years and I knew I recognized the face, but I couldn't place her. Right. And she came up during the break and she said, I am not sure if you remember me, but I'm da 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 da.
Right.
And I'll never forget what you did for me. Mm-hmm. And it it's like, you know, what did I do? I couldn't remember. And anyways, long story short, I referred her to a physician and it turned out she was diagnosed with something, which was then addressed. Mm-hmm. She took some time off from school and then was able to go back the next year and finish strong, moved on, finished graduate school, got licensed. She's married, has a family.
Wonderful,
and here she is now in her mid-30s. And she said, I've never forgotten you taking the time to talk to me after class. And then I got really teary. I'm like, oh my gosh, I remember. And so there's so much power in our words.
Right.
And even you as physicians, your hands are like healing hands, you know, what you touch, even just holding a patient's hand, just sitting with them and engaging with them, it can be a life changer.
Right.
Giving someone the time of day, putting the humanness back in the work. It doesn't cost anything to do that.
Correct. It does not.
Yeah.
You know, just doing good never costs you, you know?
Right.
So, wow. That's definitely wonderful to hear, honestly. And hopefully, you know, as a future physician, I can hopefully share one of those two experiences.
Yeah, you will.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Obviously, we've talked a lot about, you know, your role as a counselor, but we'll dive a little bit more towards, you know, who's Deborah Wright a little bit. As a counselor, I'm sure there's a number of times you yourself probably feel overwhelmed, you know, given the number of students you have to help, you know, or potentially will in the coming years. How do you work with that? And what do you do as Dr. Deborah Wright, you know, to get through this yourself and work with it?
Yeah, that's, you know, another great question. My kids are older now. My work was more difficult when I was raising them. I mean, I have a spouse who's a great partner and, and shared responsibility and all that. But it's a lot harder when you're juggling pickups and drop-offs and who's taking this one to the sporting event, who's going to that, and all of those things and you know, band recitals, piano recitals, and all of that. They're older now, so they don't need me in the same way. So I find that I have more time to focus on me. Mm-hmm. So I'm in a good space right now. So my youngest just finished her first year of college. So this has been a transition year, and it's really been a year of, okay, what do I do with all this time?
Right.
So I garden, I love reading, talking, and just spending time with my family. However, years ago, when all my kids were home, there was a lot of juggling. It was very stressful.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
Yeah. So for me, it was finding that community, finding other people in my space, family and friends and whatnot, who had kids. So we would get together on the weekends, and so the kids could play, and at least we could have grown-up conversation. Right. We would break bread together and you know, do things like that. Mm-hmm. I had to make that happen.
Right.
Not just for the kids, but for us grown-ups, because those times were rare. And if I needed to find a professional to talk to, I would. There's no shame in it.
Exactly.
You have to recognize it and address it as it comes up.
I mean, no, that's definitely something to take away. You know, at the end of the day, it comes to, you know, taking one initiative yourself and like just trying to make sure you find your own community. And those two things can do wonders for you, you know, if you stick with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, good to hear. I mean, that all has been really interesting to hear, you know. So where do you see, you know, the field of counseling heading in the future? I know, obviously, we touched upon a little bit of the laws that are being passed around or potentially will be passed around. But what's your take on the future of just counseling or therapy in general?
Well, if there's ever a time to be in the field of mental health counseling, it's now. Mental health issues are at an all-time high. Were they there before and we just didn't know about it? Perhaps. I'm not quite sure which, if the pandemic kind of, you know, helped dig all of this up even more or what. But it's not going to go away. Mm-hmm. And so we need trained professionals to meet the needs of people who need to be seen.
Exactly.
And just like, you know, we have a shortage of physicians in the IE, I don't think have enough mental health, licensed mental health clinicians.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I hope by the end of this, maybe hopefully one or two people at least are inspired to, you know, do something in the field of therapy or counseling because we truly do need those professionals, you know. And honestly, counselors can range from so many different fields to so many different lives, you know, pediatrics to adults to elderly, you know, and whether you're a professional or not, you know, one way or another, a counselor can definitely help you, you know, be better or just like move on to do better things, hopefully. Yeah. But yeah, that's definitely good to hear. Thank you. So we touched briefly on the advice you would give someone seeking to become a counselor, but over your time here at CUSM and in higher ed, I'm talking to other medical students. What is the advice you would give incoming medical students, you know, how they should perhaps prepare for medical school, something they should know of? You know, obviously there's vast amount of things one can probably say, but is there any key things you would like to point out?
I think you all could tell them. to try and have fun during the process. It's going to be grueling. I mean, there's no easy way to sum it up, right? It's a ride. But to try and enjoy the process as you're going through it, and again, to seek out resources, seek out help, not to just stay by yourself and think nobody understands or think that you don't belong you know, you don't belong here, you're not as smart as the other students, everybody is getting, you know, this on this particular exam and you didn't. Well, do you know everybody's scores? You know,
right.
It's just not trying not to overthink things. And if mm-hmm. you have a tendency to do that, to recognize that and mm-hmm. figure out how to deal with that, mm-hmm. you're all cream of the crop. I mean, you wouldn't have gotten here if you weren't top students. Right. I like to remind people of their process.
Right.
What were the steps that it took for you to get here? What sacrifices did you make? Mm-hmm. You have just as much right to be here as anybody else. You earned your seat at the table.
Right.
You're all here.
Right.
So just try and enjoy it. Some of these friendships, relationships that you will make during this 4-year period will be lifelong.
Right.
You might find a partner here. You might, you know, best friend, or, you know, somebody you go into practice with down the line. You just never know. So just remain open mm-hmm. to the process. Try and enjoy it. Try and participate. Get involved in a student organization. Just mm-hmm. do something. Don't just stay by yourself and isolate.
Right. I guess that's also a good way to approach the imposter syndrome. You know, like, I feel like that truly never goes away. Mm-hmm. It probably just gets toned down a little bit. But having, you know, being that involved, having your own community and just talking to people lets you know that, you know, you do belong here. Mm-hmm. And then others do want you here as well at the same time. So it's definitely something that takes time but could be worked with, I would say, you know?
Absolutely.
But yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and insights, Dr. Wright, with us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and hopefully have you around, you know. And one of these days, you'll see me in one of those offices. Before we wrap up, could you tell our listeners how they can connect with you or learn a little bit more about you?
Sure. I'm on LinkedIn, and also my COSM email, which is Wright, WRIGHTD, at COSM.org.
Appreciate it. Well, thank you so much for listening, everyone.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you have any comments, questions, or episode suggestions, please email us at oumpodcast@cusm.org. That's oumpodcast@cusm.org. Thanks.